Là, j'ai le grand plaisir d'introduire le premier invité de la chaire de philosophie du langage et de l'esprit au Collège de France. Un invité prestigieux, le professeur Peacock de l'Université Columbia, que beaucoup d'entre vous connaissent, et qui va nous donner un cycle de conférences, ou disons plutôt deux cycles de conférences. Un premier cycle de deux conférences sur la conscience musicale, donc on entend aujourd'hui la première de ces deux conférences. Et ensuite, il y aura un autre mini-cycle sur les normes et le réalisme, avec une période d'interruption d'une semaine entre les deux. Et donc, étant donné les circonstances, le premier cycle se tient devant une assistance réduite à huis clos. Et heureusement, à partir du 19 mai, et donc à temps pour le deuxième mini-cycle, nous aurons de nouveau le droit d'ouvrir au public, et donc les conférences sur les normes et le réalisme seront de nouveau publiques. Chris.
Bon, merci beaucoup. So, I thank the Assembly of Professors of the Collège and Professor Recanati for the invitation to give these lectures at this wonderful and unique institution. In my own discipline of philosophy, earlier lecturers have set a formidable standard to which I would be very happy to come even close, even to approach. So there are two lectures on music to begin, the first of the mini-cycle that Francois just mentioned. Here's a series of questions that may well occur to anyone who loves music and who reflects upon the perception of music. These are the kinds of questions you might just think about when driving in the countryside or taking a walk. How is it so much is even possible to hear emotions and modalities of action, such as determination and weakness in music, which after all is just a sequence of sound events? How can we hear in music objective events, such as the lapping of the water on the side of a boat, something that Schubert can do in an instant in a song, in a musical accompaniment? How is it that music can add so much powerful, effective content and be so much more powerful for when we hear a text set to music than just the written text itself, or even the spoken text? Why is it that the emotional effect of music is so much stronger sometimes when we actually see the performer? It can make an enormous difference. Scientific studies have shown precisely that. How is it that we can sometimes experience new emotions in music, emotions we've never experienced before? Music can affect our actual mood. We can make sense of the idea that in instrumental music, in a symphony, or even just in a string quartet, there can be drama. How can there be drama in music? And there seems to be such a thing as understanding music better, or understanding it worse. Those questions, which I simply plucked random from the air, they're just a small proper subset of those that will occur to any reflective music lover. And of course, I wish I knew the answer to all of them. But what I want to be offering in this lecture and the next are some resources that seem to me promising in constructing some initial answers. I think the good answers to these questions have to draw on philosophy, and in particular to draw upon the philosophy of mind. I think the philosophy of mind, properly deployed, has a huge amount to contribute to our understanding of music. Musical phenomena, both as data and as challenge, have an equally large contribution to make in advancing our understanding of mental philosophy too, more generally, mental phenomena, I beg your pardon. And I'll try to illustrate those claims as we go along. And I'll give some preliminary examples of ways in which I think a happy marriage between music and the philosophy of mind can produce a vast family of ideas, ideas that can be applied in the history of music, in musicology, music criticism, and in the empirical psychology of music. A large part of philosophy in whatever area is concerned with the constitutive, that is, with what makes something the case, what makes something have a certain property. I wouldn't say that's the whole of philosophy, but it's a vast part of it. And much of the philosophical investigation of music, I think, ought to fall squarely into that category. Certainly much of what I will be trying to claim does so. The most fundamental questions in the philosophical investigation of music are constitutive ones about the nature of the perception of music. What is it to hear a particular emotion or anything else in a passage of music? Are there constitutive limits on the nature of musical experience to what we can hear in music? What is it to hear emotional development in a piece of music? If we don't get the answers to these foundational questions right, we're likely to make mistakes, not only in the philosophy of music, but I think in all those other potential offspring that I mentioned, in music criticisms, in the history of music, in our assessment of the point and significance of scientific investigations into music. Anyway, in these general respects, I myself regard the possible contributions of philosophy to the understanding of music as entirely structurally similar to the possible contributions philosophy makes to other disciplines and other understanding of other mental phenomena. Okay, so let's get down to some nitty-gritty. Initially, the perception of music is simply the perception of pitch, volume, timbre, location in tonal space or in atonal space, location in metrical and rhythmic structure. Those are broadly the aspects of musical perception that involve sensation and syntax. Beyond those perceptible properties, there are two further broad categories involved in the perception of music. The first category is that of the broad range of psychological states that can be heard in or intimately involved in our perception of music. The second is the category of agency. Music, in its central and explanatorily most fundamental cases, is perceived as the exercise of agency. These two broad categories are intertwined, both as a matter of the nature of musical perception and as a matter of its aesthetics. But since we can only deal with one topic at a time, I'll consider the psychological states involved in the perception of music in this first lecture, and I'll address the involvement of agency in the next lecture. But there will be some leakage between the two, as you'll see. Okay, I want to talk now about three kinds of involvement of mental states in the perception of music. And for each of these three kinds, I want to do three things. First, to give an intuitive characterization of what's involved with some examples. Second, to give a more substantive, constitutive philosophical explanation of the nature of each of them. And third, to draw on this more substantive characterization to explain various distinctive features of the perception of music, of musical styles, and indeed some phenomena in empirical psychology. Let me start by drawing a distinction. All performed music is normally perceived as action. We hear the sound events as exercises of agency. But in some cases, we not only hear the music as action, we hear expressive action in the music, which is an additional thing. So here are some examples. And these examples were set up originally in iTunes with a sort of a start point and a finish point. And I may have some difficulty replicating exactly where the start point and finishing point is meant to be, so bear with me. Here is a famous piece by Charles Ives, which starts off with some beautiful serene string music, and then you hear something, you perceive something as expressive action in the music. It's very natural to hear the trumpet solo there as questioning something, being some kind of questioning response to the beautiful string music. And indeed, of course, that piece is called The Unanswered Question. And you can perceive the trumpet as, in some way, questioning what's gone before, even if you don't know the title of the piece. There's many phenomena in well-known pieces of music in which you hear features of the music as expressive action. Sometimes you actually hear something as a sigh in the music. If you know, for popular recent music, if you know Radiohead's song, Let Down, the words let down sound like a sigh, disappointment. If you think about Schubert's song, Gretchen am Spinnrader, Sein Kuss, his kiss, the music goes up, you hear it as expressive action. I'm not going to just go through a huge range of musical auditory examples here, but for those of you familiar with the huge range of phenomena in the Western repertoire, you can hear music as sarcastic action. There's a famous passage in, rather unfair passage in Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, where he expresses sarcasm, and you hear laughter in the orchestra at certain features of Shostakovich's music. You will find parts of Lutoslawski's scores where the instructions are to play the music aggressively. You hear expressive action in the music. And I'm going to call these cases agentially expressive. That's the first of the three kinds. In a wider range of cases, however, we hear psychological states in the music without hearing expressive action in the music. And in these cases, which I call purely expressive, we hear an emotion, a mood, or some modality of action, such as struggle or determination or weakness, without hearing in the music an action that's expressive of the state of mind that's heard in the music. So, if I can handle this technology properly here. Here is a very serene piece of music, but you don't hear this kind of serene agency in the music.
Bonjour à tous. Tout d'abord, un grand merci.
Excuse me, that's the wrong thing. Okay, so that was some Mozart, 39th Symphony. It's not only emotions of joy, disappointment, and so forth you hear in the music. You hear modalities of action. You hear types of action. You hear determination. You can hear weakness. If I can get this one to play, this. Many people hear the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, I think quite rightly, as some kind of determination to overcome struggle. There's some kind of external force in those first four notes, and there's a determination, resolve, overcoming difficulty is heard in the music. It's very striking. There are less dramatic, less heroic modalities of action you can hear in the music. Recent psychologists have discussed the phenomenon of what they call mind wandering. Mind wandering is not agency. Mind wandering is where you just let things come to mind. It's not a mental action of judgment. You're letting your mind wander, so it's not mental agency. But it's still a modality of consciousness. It's really an extraordinary achievement of Debussy that you can hear that in one of his pieces of music. Indeed, it's called Reverie. So here's Reverie, and you can hear the mind wandering in the music. Thank you. need some help in stopping this. Do we have the audio? Okay, here. Okay. There we go. Okay, thank you. Okay, so there's a huge range of things you can hear in the music. Okay, I can stop it that way. There we've got two kinds of involvements of mental states so far. We've got hearing something as expressive action in the music, and the case of the purely expressive, where you hear some mental state, like an emotion, modality of action in the music. And I've characterized both of those just in a very intuitive way. There's a third kind of involvement of mental states in the perception of music. And this is something that's not a case of agential expression. It's not a case where you hear an emotion or action modality in the music. It's rather a matter of how the music strikes us. So in this third case, this is a mental state that takes as its object what's already heard in the music. It's something that's constitutively and causally subsequent to what's heard in the music. So in this third kind of case, for instance, what's heard in the music strikes the listener, for instance, as terrifying or as awesome. The music doesn't express terror or awe, but we don't understand the music unless we are struck by the music in a certain way. So if you take Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, that's probably the best and most obvious example. We don't appreciate that work unless we're struck with the awesome and even terrifying character, the primitive non-rational forces and their effect in human life that are given in the music. But the music doesn't express awe or terror, and we don't hear awe or terror in the music, nor is the music a representation of terror. There are other very different cases in which terror is heard in the music. So the shower scene in Psycho and Bernard Herrmann's score, that's what it is to express terror in the music. There are many, many other examples of that too. In this third kind of case that I'll be discussing much later in this lecture, maybe a little bit more next time, this could be called reactive content. You have a certain kind of emotional reaction to what's heard in the music, but you have to hear things in the music in the first place for the reaction to be there. So what I said I would do about each of these three kinds is to say something about their nature and to draw on this account of their nature in a good account, to try to develop a good account of what's involved in the perception of music. And I'll try to characterize the way in which we hear these states in the music in such a way that it becomes a resource you can draw on in the philosophy of music. The agentially expressive case is philosophically not so problematic, I think. It's one in which the music is experienced as similar to an expressive action itself. So the changing pitch of this trumpet solo in Charles Ives' The Unanswered Question, that's experienced as similar to the intonation contour of an uttered question. Similarly, a long upward leap in pitch with stress on the upper note, followed by a gradual descent in pitch, that can be experienced as similar to a moan or a cry of disappointment. The relevant features of the passage of music are not experienced merely metaphorically as actions. They're experienced as similar to an expressive action. And I think we can't understand the nature and limits of agentially expressive music unless we draw an account of expressive action itself. Let me identify a series of properties here of expressive action, each of which is relevant to our perception of agentially expressive music. First of all, in expressive action, there's always some mental state or modality of action that's expressed. So it's always legitimate to talk of and ask after what it is that's expressed in such actions. Second, there's no such thing as expressing in one's actions an experience of green or the taste of banana. What's expressed in action is always some general affect or modality of action, which, though it may be specific in intensity and character, doesn't involve such perceptual states as an experience of green or the taste of banana. Third, the psychological explanation of expressive action is not a matter of means-end reasoning about what will achieve the agent's goals. On this point, I'm entirely in agreement with a main thesis of an excellent article by Rosalind Hursthaus called Arational Action. In not being explained by belief goal structures, expressive action is a direct manifestation of an affect or of a psychological modality of action. The explanation of expressive action is explanation by the magnitude of some affect or psychological modality of action. In that respect, it doesn't have this kind of rational computational explanation. Okay, let me go a few more characteristics. Although expressive action isn't explained by means-end reasoning, a subject nevertheless has some control over how the mental relevant mental state is expressed. You may, in an instance of expressive action, knock somebody's financial papers off his desk in anger at some kind of financial skullduggery or cheating, rather than just kicking his chair. There's also the phenomenon of letting the emotion or action modality control the specifics of one's action. So it's a mixture here. It's not exactly unfree. Like other actions, expressive action is mentally represented in a unified action perception way. For a huge range of human action types, we know both what it would be like to perform one of them, and we also have the ability to perceive the type as instantiated in a particular action. The same way of thinking of the action is involved in these two capacities. So for a huge range of cases, it's not informative that it's the same type in the first and third person cases. That's one of the lessons from the mirror neuron literature from Northern Italy. Okay, when we combine these features of expressive action with the earlier account of what it is to hear expressive action in music, we can explain various properties of such musical perception. According to the earlier thesis, we hear expressive action in some music passage. To hear it as expressive action is to experience that passage as similar to expressive action, action that is itself perceived as expressing a certain affect or action modality. The affect or action modality enters the content of the subject's hearing the expressive action in the music. The directness of the affect or action modality in expressive action is thus embedded in the musical experience, in our consciousness of the music. All that's required to hear expressive action in the music is the ability to experience something as similar to ordinary expressive action with its perceived affect or action modality. So one can see why some thinkers attempted to make claims about the universal accessibility of this aspect of musical expression. That claim about universal accessibility is certainly an overstatement. But for normal humans, with the ability to perceive something as similar to, though also distinct from, certain cases of expressive action, together with an everyday and non-specialist experience of music, those two in combination will be sufficient to appreciate features of music that are agentially expressive. So these points, these sort of simple philosophical points, including the directness of the explanation of expressive action and the perceptibility of affect and action modality, were indeed well known to the composer Richard Wagner. So here's a quotation from Wagner's centenary essay on Beethoven. This is immediately evident this is Wagner, not Peacock, 10 sentences. Wagner wrote, "The object of the tone perceived is brought into immediate rapport with the subject of the tone emitted. Without any reasoning go-between, we understand the cry for help, the wail, the shout of joy, and straightway answer it in its own tongue. If the scream, the moan, the murmured happiness in our own mouth is the most direct utterance of the will's emotion, so when brought us by our own ear, we understand it past denial as utterance of the same emotion. No illusion is possible here, as in the daylight show, to make us deem the essence of the world outside us not wholly identical with our own, and that gulf which seems to sight is closed forthwith." These cases of agentially expressive music are cases in which the so-called contour theory of music, which is found in Stephen Davis, is, I think, far more plausible than it is for the cases that I've classified as purely expressive. The contour theory states, in Stephen Davis's words, that the range of aesthetic responses that may be made to musical works corresponds to the range of emotions that may be mirrored by emotion characteristics in appearances. And a form of that approach, of course, goes right back to Rousseau. It's a Rousseau-like thought. It's clear, I think, that the contour theory can't cover all the cases of emotion that's heard in music, and indeed that it can't is explicitly endorsed by Davis. The range of emotions we're capable of hearing in music, triumph, disappointment, struggle, serenity, hope, bitterness, to identify only a few, they vastly outrun the range of types of facial or other bodily expressions or perceptible types of gesture that we can perceptually recognize. Consider, for instance, melancholy. You can certainly hear that in the opening, for example, of Elgar's cello concerto, but there's no specific emotion characteristic in the appearance of faces or bodily gestures or actions for melancholy that would distinguish it from other cases of negative affect. An obvious move is to restrict the contour theory to agentially expressive cases. And with that restriction on its scope, the contour theory, I think, is much more plausible as an account, at least, of the causal basis of the phenomenology of agential expression in music. And the substantive account of agential expression that I just offered is precisely that such cases involve experience similarity to cases of expressive action. And the experience similarity is presumably explained by actual similarity in some specifiable physical respect, a similarity that's picked up by the human perceptual system. Okay. Now let me move to the purely expressive cases before I get to some real philosophical meat. So much for the description of the agentially expressive cases. In the purely expressive cases, we hear certain features of the music metaphorically as some mental state, emotion, mood, or some other subjective state. Hearing some feature of the music metaphorically as something else has a much wider extension than just hearing mental states and action modalities in the music. We can hear features of the music metaphorically as the water rising around a sunken cathedral, as in Debussy's famous work. We can hear it as the sun rising, again, thanks to Debussy. You can hear something as the water lapping on the side of a boat. You can even hear some passages of music as the milling of a crowd. Shostakovich achieves that in the 1905 symphony. Sometimes even very simple rhythmic structures without any discernible pitch can be experienced metaphorically in the most striking ways. So as those who know Ligeti's poem Symphonique, that consists of starting off about 100 metronomes starting, going at different speeds, and they gradually run down, the springs gradually run down, until there's only just one going then. This is an intensely moving work, and you experience the back and forth of metronomes as lives passing and gradually ending. You experience one thing there metaphorically as something else. When in the purely expressive case we experience certain features of the music metaphorically as some mental state or event, that mental state or event is commonly the mental state as experienced from the first person point of view. The rhythm and leaps of a melody may be experienced metaphorically as the quickened pace and affect of joy from the inside. Discontinuous and unpredictable pitch and sonority may be experienced metaphorically as pangs of fear or sudden anxiety from the first person point of view. Passages of the last movement of Beethoven's Hammerklavier piano sonata are experienced as a titanic struggle against opposing forces. And as one would expect, a great composer will integrate music heard as agentially expressive with features of the music heard as expressive of suitably corresponding action modalities. I think that the perceptual phenomenon of experiencing something metaphorically as something else is an instance of a more general phenomenon in human mental states, the phenomenon of representing one thing metaphorically as something else. So you can imagine one thing as something else, as when you imagine the nucleus of an atom and the electrons orbiting it as a solar system with orbiting planets. You can think of one thing metaphorically as something else, as when Romeo thinks of Juliet as the sun. So under the conception I advocate for the second class of cases, metaphor is not something fundamentally linguistic. In fact, I would say metaphor in language exists only because you need language to express independently existing mental states with metaphorical content. those mental states may be perceptual states, may be states of thought, may be states of imagination. All metaphor involves in some way or other an isomorphism between two domains. Musical experience of one feature metaphorically as something else exploits an isomorphism between features of the music and what they heard metaphorically as. The music does not, of course, make the isomorphism explicit. It takes thought and reflection on experience to formulate the isomorphism that's being exploited. Formulating the isomorphism is not at all necessary for hearing features of the music metaphorically as something else. Let me, for purposes of clarification, just list a few things that musical content in the purely expressive case is not. Musical content in the purely expressive case is not representational content in the sense of content that's represented as correct when one hears the music as having that content. There is, of course, representational content in music. Musical experience can represent or misrepresent, in the case of illusions, one note as being a fifth above its predecessor, can represent something as being the local tonal center, can represent some note as occurring on the downbeat, and so forth. But those aren't the contents concerning psychological states in which we're interested when we talk about the content of the music as joyful or melancholy or resolute and so forth. There's nothing that really seems to be in a melancholy, joyful, or resolute state of mind when you hear those states in the music. In this respect, hearing mental states in the music is not a case of hearing as, when hearing as is understood as hearing the world to be a certain way. As, for instance, when in a restaurant, one hears a sound as the shattering of china on the floor. Okay. Hearing mental states in the music is also not to be identified with imagining something in the music. And I think in this respect, hearing the music is on a par with perceiving a painting, or more generally, perceiving a depiction. However much you imagine something in a pattern of lines on a surface, that doesn't amount to seeing a depiction of something there. However much you imagine something in the music, that doesn't amount to hearing something in the music. The experience of depictions and the experience of music is specifically perceptual, and imagination does not suffice for it, and indeed may even detract from it. Such different writers as Edward Hanslick, a long time ago, and Kendall Walton more recently, have appealed to imagination in describing our experience of music. But these very simple points seem to me to tell against those approaches. Finally, by way of clarification, two points. First of all, perceptual experience, including musical experience, is something that happens to you. It's not an exercise of mental agency at the personal level. In that respect, hearing a passage of music in a certain way is not a mental action. And finally, by way of clarification on this state, to say that hearing a mental state in the music is hearing certain features of the music metaphorically as something else is not to imply that there are some things that can be described only by using metaphor. On the contrary, when we say a person hears features of the music metaphorically as joyful, we are speaking literally. The literal talk is about an experiential content that involves metaphor. We're equally speaking literally when we say that Romeo thinks of Juliet as the sun. We must always distinguish using a metaphor from mentioning a metaphor. I'm mentioning metaphors in this philosophical characterization. The idea that there's something in the universe that can, in principle, be described only metaphorically is not only false, it's incoherent. A metaphorical description, when good, relies on the existence of an isomorphism from one domain to another. A good metaphorical description can exist only if there's a possible literal description of the phenomenon in question, a description determined by the relevant isomorphism, even if it takes thought to work out what that is. Although the idea of something that can be in principle be described only by the use of metaphor is incoherent, it's nevertheless actually found in some of the philosophical literature on music. Okay, I now want to come to what's in some ways the central part of this first talk. And I want here now to address this question. In what ways are emotions and action modalities given when they feature in what's heard in the music? When you hear anxiety, nostalgia, serenity, or determination in the music, it can be tempting to insist that you hear these very states themselves in the music. You're certainly not merely thinking of them under some concept. And there's certainly something that's right in this temptation. You don't need to have the general concepts of nostalgia or serenity or determination to hear states of nostalgia or serenity or determination in the music, any more than you need to possess the concepts in order to be in those states. But what can it mean to say that you hear the states themselves in the music? It cannot be that you experience those very states themselves in hearing the music. It's obviously wrong. You can hear the music as serene without yourself being in a serene state, and similarly for all the other cases. There's also a further puzzle here too. When you hear nostalgia in the music, you can hear a particular kind of nostalgia, gentle or intense, sweet or not so sweet, and similarly for serenity, determination, and all the other states you can hear in the music. Not only is there a quite specific form of that state, even more puzzlingly, we seem to be able to make sense of a demonstrative that refers that degree of nostalgia, that degree of particularly sweet nostalgia, even though no state of nostalgia need be instantiated in the mind of the listener to the music. How is all this possible? The way in which the emotion or action modality is given when it's heard in the music is of a special kind. It is obviously not a mode of presentation, use of which requires the hearer to be in the emotional state, since the hearer need not be in that state. Same applies to the action modalities. But there is a distinctively first-personal way of representing a conscious state that does not involve being in that very state, but which is available, in the nature of the case, to those who know what it's like subjectively to be in that state. Imagining being in pain, imagining tasting a Burgundy wine, do not, respectively, fortunately, unfortunately, involve being in pain or involve experiencing a taste of a Burgundy wine. But they both require and embed knowledge of what it's like to be in those states. The same applies to episodic memory of experiences too. The ways in which the pain and the taste of Burgundy are given in those imaginings and memories, the way in which they latch on to specific types of pains and tastes, they do so in such a way as to make available, referring demonstratives, that kind of pain, that kind of Burgundy taste. I call such modes of presentation of conscious states Jacksonian, in honor of Frank Jackson, in honor of Frank Jackson and his rightly influential discussion of what the colorblind scientist doesn't know about the property of being red, thought of as the property of being red. And I propose the hypothesis that the way in which emotions and action modalities are given when we hear an emotion or an action modality in a piece of music are Jacksonian. This hypothesis would explain the distinctive features of the way in which these states are given in music, present as they are also in imagination and in episodic memory. The Jacksonian character of the modes of presentation under which mental states are given in the perception of music, I think, provides an explanation for four salient facts about musical perception. It explains a principle that I identified in some earlier writing, which I called the principle of musical acquaintance. I think the Jacksonian character can also explain a certain kind of specificity of what's heard in the music. It can explain how setting words to music can make such a difference. And it, I think, allows us to draw a distinction between what's right and what's wrong in talking of the ineffability of the content of music. Let me take these four in turn, and then I'll draw things to a close. First, the principle of musical acquaintance states that everything a person can hear in the music is something with which the hearer is acquainted, the analog of Russell's principle of acquaintance. If the principle is true, it certainly cries out for some explanation of its truth. It certainly can't be just an accident, it holds case by case. Suppose we grant that when a mental state is heard in the music, it's given under a Jacksonian mode of presentation. Being in a mental state with a Jacksonian mode of presentation in its content constitutively involves, as a matter of the individuation of that content, an acquaintance relation to the state of which it's a mode of presentation. Without the subject standing in an acquaintance relation to those states, the Jacksonian modes of presentation would be unavailable to the subject. So if the ways in which mental states are given when heard in the music are Jacksonian modes of presentation, mental states that are heard in the music will be ones with which the hearer is acquainted. And that little argument applies as much to action modalities heard in the music as it does to the emotions. Actually, the argument can, I think, be extended to non-mental properties and event types that can be heard in the music. We do stand in an acquaintance relation to the property of water rising up around a building, to the property of the wind blowing on the plane, to the event type of crowds milling, when we're capable of perceiving such states of affairs as such. The capacity for such perceptual acquaintance allows us to hear these event types in the music. we're capable of thinking of events of these types, in ways that are not purely descriptive, but involve relations of perception, acquaintance, and recognition. And we draw on them when we hear the music in those ways. It's the first thing that will be explained by it being Jacksonian modes of presentation under which emotions and action modalities are given in perception of music. Second, when we hear sadness or joy or determination in a passage of music, what we hear is something much more definite than sadness in general or joy in general or determination in general. It'll be something much more specific, the possibilities ranging from mild joy to the ecstatic, from mild sadness to deep grief or despair. This specificity is what, in some earlier writing, I called Mendelssohnian specificity, in honor of Mendelssohn's famous response when he was asked what words he would put to his songs without words. In answer to that question, Mendelssohn wrote this in a letter. He said, "The thoughts that are expressed to me by music that I love are not too indefinite to be put into words, but on the contrary, too definite. And so I find," Mendelssohn goes on, "in every effort to express such thoughts, something that is right, but at the same time, something is lacking in all of them. And if I happen to have had words in mind for one or another of these songs, I would never want to tell them to anyone, because the same words never mean the same things to different people," since which he's concerned. "Only the song can say the same thing, can arouse the same feelings in one person as in another, a feeling that is not expressed, however, by the same words." End of the quote. A smart man. The definiteness of the states that can be heard in the music is explained by the fact that those states are given under Jacksonian modes of presentation. Imagining a pain, remembering the taste of the Burgundy you drank, it can involve definite kinds of pain, taste, even if they're not as determinate as the experience itself. The specific feelings, as Mendelssohn says, the emotions, the action modalities that are heard in the music have a two-way independence from any text or sequence of images of which they might be taken as expressive. The same passage of absolute music may be suitable for the expression of multiple different texts or sequences of representations of the world. And in the opposite direction, any given sequence of images or text will have multiple different possible and appropriate musical expressions, with different states heard in the various possible texts and sequences of images when so associated. Third, I think this combination of Mendelssohnian specificity and two-way independence is crucial in explaining how much music can add to a text. Since we have this two-way independence, the composer has enormous freedom in what emotion and action modalities are to be heard in the music to which the text is set, or which accompanies the music. In particular, the emotion action modality content of the music is hugely more specific than is given by the words in the text, and certainly not obviously predictable, even in general terms, from the text. Any music lover will know multiple examples of, that illustrate this point. I switched off the audio now, but if you think about the actual text, the opening text of the poem The Erlking, Erlkönig, that Schubert set at the age of 17, it just says, a father is riding late at night, holding a child, warm and secure. Music doesn't sound like that at all. The music is extremely ominous, blah, 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 in the left hand. It's extremely somber and threatening. Obviously, something bad is going to happen. We could go on and on with examples. There's all sorts of ways in which the music can add to the expressive power of the words. I've just got a list of things here you can add, as in the case of the Schubert song. There can be intensification, much greater intensity can the expressed emotion is available when you've got a musical setting, even quite simple texts. You can connect one text with another by repeating the same music and illustrate all kinds of dramatic points. This was something that worried another great thinker, Augustine. In his Confessions, the ever insightful Augustine articulated an ambivalence about the power of music. I'll read a paragraph from Augustine's Confessions. Though he wrote in the language of his period, when you read a passage like this in Augustine, you hear this fantastic intelligence coming through. So here's what he wrote. "I admit that I still find some enjoyment in the music of hymns, which are alive with your praises," he's addressing God here, "when I hear them sung by well-trained melodious voices. But I do not enjoy it so much that I can't tear myself away. I can leave it when I wish. But if I'm not to turn a deaf ear to music, which is the setting for the words that give it life, I must allow it a position of some honor in my heart, and I find it difficult to assign to its proper place. For something I feel I treat it with more honor than it deserves. I realize that when they're sung, these sacred words stir my mind to greater religious fervor and kindle in me a more ardent flame of piety than they would if they were not sung. And I also know that there are particular modes ensongued in the voice, corresponding to my various emotions, and able to stimulate them because of some mysterious relationship between the two. But I ought not to allow my mind to be paralyzed by the gratification of my senses, which often leads it astray, for the senses are not content to take a second place. I sometimes sin in this way. Without committing myself to an irrevocable opinion, I'm inclined to approve of the custom of singing in church, in order that by indulging the ears, weaker spirits may be inspired with feelings of devotion. Yet when I find the singing itself more moving than the truth which it conveys, I confess this is a grievous sin, he ends the passage. Augustine's dilemma can be formulated very concisely. What he enjoys, as he would say sinfully, is the music with its Mendelssohnian specificity, but which, as he so precisely states, does not in its nature have any intrinsic connection with the religious content of the words. That's an example, one direction of the two-way independence we've noted of Mendelssohnian specificity from any particular content concerning the world. Fourth consequence of the identification of Jacksonian modes of presentation as crucial to our perception of the emotions actually as in music, that I think it provides the basis for elaborating a distinction between the good and the unacceptable characterizations of ineffability in music. So first then, for the good characterizations. We already have a form of ineffability doctrine in the point that the fine-grained mental states heard in the passage of music, even one that involves either the setting of words or a program giving language, is more specific than is fixed by the meaning of the words set or the language of the program. Still, we need to be careful in the formulation here and arguments about a claim of ineffability, it's a modal claim of the impossibility of a certain kind of linguistic expression. When some fine-grained emotional state is heard in a piece of music, it seems evident anyone who hears that state in the music is also capable of making reference to that state, of thinking that state has such and such properties, and of uttering a sentence expressing that thought. So the ineffability is not absolute, so how should we formulate the claim more precisely? I think a better characterization should take account of precisely the limits implied by the role of acquaintance in the notion of a Jacksonian mode of presentation. We may be able to express in thought and language the mental state that's heard in a piece of music, but the concepts and words used in such expressions can be fully understood only by someone who has the relevant acquaintance relation to the mental state heard in the music and deploys it properly. And I think the ineffability of what's heard in the music should be so characterized as subject to that restriction. And I think one could make similar points about the ineffability of what's heard in a poem. In my view, it's right to associate this legitimate and important form of ineffability in music, as Caroline Abbati has done, with as what she calls music as performed, with a perception of particular physical events that are actions in real time. The association of the two is underwritten and explained by this approach, because we can make sense of the experience of, for instance, hearing certain features of the music metaphorically as something else, only fundamentally as an experience on a particular occasion of a particular sound event. We may, for one purpose or another, abstract from such singular historical events a certain type of experience available to listeners of a certain passage of music, but the type is fundamentally individuated by features of particular events of listening to real musical performances. So at this point, I fully endorse Caroline Abbati's statement that, quote, ignoring real music, the musical event, and scorning ineffability go hand in hand because they're interdependent. It's real music, music as performed, that engenders physical and spiritual conditions wherein sound might suggest multiple concrete meanings and associations. It's a quote from a famous article, Music Drastic or Gnostic. While there's much that's not understood about conscious experience, about its very nature, about its computational and physical realizations, there's nothing, as far as I can tell, intrinsically and irredeemably problematic in the descriptions I've given so far of musical experience. But things are very different when we come to the puzzling descriptions of ineffability in music that have been offered by some writers. So in reporting one such description, Judy Lockhead of Yale writes, she writes, for Jankelevich, listening to music provides access to a Bergsonian absolute knowledge of reality, and hence gives listeners a direct, unmediated encounter with an experientiality that defies any intellectual engagement with that experience, including any form of linguistic expression, unquote. Similarly, Schopenhauer seems to have thought that music provides some kind of access to the will that's not available by any other means. The reasons I think that such characterizations of ineffability are unintelligible are twofold. First, what's heard in the music is always something that can be experienced in some other non-musical way. And indeed, part of Schopenhauer, that applies to the states of the will too, once we recognize modalities of action as part of our ordinary conscious, non-musical, ordinary experience of agency. It's precisely because the states heard in music are ones enjoyed or suffered outside music that that music can be of emotional and aesthetic value to us. If music represented states of affairs that were otherwise inaccessible to us, nature of the case, it wouldn't have that value for us. And I'll return to that issue later on. Second reason for the unintelligibility of this idea of a contact in music with an otherwise inaccessible reality is implicit in what I said earlier. The content of music is, in any case, not representational content, so it can't represent anything about any kind of reality at all. Content of music is not representational content. Musical experience in respect of what is heard in the music, as opposed to the perception of rich timbre or rhythm, and that's not what the ineffability theorists are talking about, is not as of something's being the case. A fortiori, it's not as of something being the case in some otherwise inaccessible realm. A sympathetic reading of the wilder parts of Schopenhauer and Jankelevich is that while they both have genuine insights about the range of contents that can be experienced in music, those insights, which are genuine, I think, have been embodied in their writings in a metaphysics that ends up precisely by denying those very insights. Let me talk very briefly about the third kind of involvement. I may say more about it next time. Third kind of involvement in the emotions identified in our appreciation of music concerns our emotional reaction to our experience of the musical events, where this reactive emotional experience is independent of our perceptual experience of the musical events. In this respect, the third kind of involvement differs both from the agentially expressive and the purely expressive. In both the agentially expressive and the purely expressive, the emotional and affective component is a component of the way the musical event is perceived. The emotional reaction of the third kind is not a component of the way the musical event is perceived, it's rather a complex reaction to that perception. And in being such a reaction to an experience that is itself independent of the reaction, the third kind of involvement of emotion in our appreciation of music can be grouped for certain purposes with our emotional reaction to drama, to films, to novels. A reaction to a good performance of Così fan tutti may be one of empathy, based on the reflection caused by the performance that, as the conductor Ivan Fischer puts it, anyone can be seduced. That's broadly analogous to our emotional and intellectual reactions to successful non-musical dramas or to great novels. All the same, there are two significant differences between instances of this third kind of involvement in the musical case and the cases of non-musical drama, films, fiction. First, emotional reactions of this third kind can occur in response to absolute music when there's no descriptive title, text, program, or setting of words to music. In the absolute cases, while the emotional reaction has an object, the states and events heard in the music, what is heard in the music will not have intentional content of the rich, world-concerning representational sort that's given by the meaning of the words in the drama or the film or the fiction. This gives the emotional reaction of the third kind, when it's present as a response to absolute music, a generality that cannot be present in the verbal representational cases. The rich Mendelssohnian specificity of the emotional content can be present in a work of absolute music. The development, the transformation, links between these rich specificities are all phenomena that can be instantiated in real-world situations of multiple different kinds, going vastly beyond any particular sequences of states of affairs specified using particular concepts expressed by words for real-world events and states of affairs. If something can be learned from a piece of absolute music, it's something applicable across a range of cases, not captured by any particular narrative in words. Second point, which I'll be discussing much more next time, applies in cases where there's some setting of words or some descriptive title or verbal program. The Jacksonian character of the modes of presentation under which the emotions, affect, and action modalities are given when one hears them in the music means that in listening, for example, to a singer and hearing such affect in the music, the hearer thereby has some acquaintance with what it's like to be in the situation expressed by the singer. When the Countess sings Por G'amor in The Marriage of Figaro, not to the Figaro, the emotion we hear in the music is given to us in a way that already acquaints us with what it's like to be in her situation, and in a way that connects us with a state given with Mendelssohnian specificity. Language by itself cannot do this, which is why opera can add expressive power that the text, however great, cannot match. The specificity and acquaintance may generate empathy in the case that's in the case of the Countess, or in the case of Scarpia, utter revulsion. But both are relevant to what can be learned from musical setting of a text. So these points about Jacksonian modes of presentation, acquaintance and specificity, apply both to the purely expressive and to the agentially expressive in music. And as I promised, I'll be turning to agency and perception more next time. But to summarize today's material, my claims, I've distinguished the agentially expressive, the purely expressive, and the reactive in discussing the mental states involved in appreciating music. I've suggested that the ways emotions and action modalities are given when heard in music are Jacksonian, the involve and acquaintance relation, and when we recognize this Jacksonian character of the way in which these states are given, we can explain various phenomena distinctive of music, including the fine-grained character of the mental states it expresses. And finally, I argue that the apparatus and distinctions I've made permit us to distinguish plausible from unintelligible theses about the ineffability of music. What we hear in music must be states that we experience in the ordinary world, and I think only in that way can it be of value and interest to us. Okay, I'll stop there for today. Thank you.